In addition to thanking the Krauses for their whole sponsorship of the conference, I really want to thank them for bringing in our next speaker. You know, Larry and Sarah have mentioned for a number of years we should bring in Mayor Sender. So here we are in 2010. He's the rabbi of the Young Israel of Sharon, Massachusetts. He has received his PhD under Dr. Chorsky at Harvard University. He teaches at Brandeis University, the Maya program at Hebrew College. I believe in Boston they have like hundreds of people coming. It's sort of a communal adult education program, I think, which is unique in North America, which he teaches. He's an expert in Kabbalah and philosophy, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to Toronto. And he flew in very early this morning, but we gave him a cup of coffee, so he's fine. Okay. Thank you.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. I appreciate that. Your wonderful hospitality, and thank you to the Krauses, longtime friends of ours. And I'm really delighted to be here for what has been a very stimulating and controversial conference. And I thought to do something a little different. Notice that all of the topics deal with important, controversial issues with the intersection of halakha and politics. And that's an important, very important theme. I thought to talk about a subject that sort of undergirds all of these topics. I just spent two sessions with Rabbi Farber, and I know all the other distinguished Rabbanim that are presenting. And what undergirds all the topics is a sense of compassion and empathy, and approaching Torah and Halakha in a compassionate and empathetic way. And I thought to look at the ground for the possibility of compassion, understand this on a halakhic basis and also on spiritual, even Kabbalistic basis, and try to put each other in touch with this ground for the possibility of compassion. In other words, I'd like this to be that learning itself issue in the kind of spiritual awareness and experience of the concept of compassion itself, of the experience. So, thought to at least let's. We'll begin with the hook to the parsha. Everyone have the sheets? You have it in Hebrew and in English. Thank you. And thank you, Alan, for distributing them. Let's hook to this week's parsha. The encounter between Yaakov and Esav. V'yoretz Esav likraso v'yichabkehu v'yipol al tzavarav v'yishakehu v'yivku. Esav ran to meet Yaakov, who's just coming back after an exile, after running away from Esav, who was out to kill him originally. And Esav hugs him, falls upon his neck, kisses him, and they cry. So the Sifrei, and Rashi brings the Sifrei, on V'yishakehu, Nakud alav, Shalom nashko b'kol libo. In the Sefer Torah, it's dotted on top of that word, V'yishakehu, he kissed him. It's little dots, you know, little staccato notes right on top of the letter of the word, to say that he didn't kiss him with all his heart. But then, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who has experience with Rome and experience with Esav, the midrashic equivalent of Rome, progenitor of Rome, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai Omer Halacha. It's a known halacha. It's not just kind of a known opinion. It's a known halacha, a strong, interesting language, that Esav hates Yaakov. But his compassion, his mercy and compassion was aroused at that moment, and he kissed him with all his heart. That moment of reconciliation, despite all of the hatred and the misunderstanding of the past, they had that moment of reconciliation. And what I'd like to look at is, how is that possible? You know, what is the ground for the possibility of compassion and understanding, reconciliation when we're estranged? What's that about? So, thought to begin in a bit of a strange place with an unusual tshuva of the Radvaz, Rav David Ibn Avi Zimra, one of the great poskim of the 16th century. He was essentially the chief rabbi of Cairo, understanding that he, and so seeing himself in the lineage of the Rambam, who was the great Rav of Cairo, he sees himself and he's self-aware as his position as an authority in Cairo. And he's one of the most prolific and authoritative poskim of the 16th century. He's also an accomplished Kabbalist, Mekubal. He is the teacher of the Arizal, Rav Yitzchak Luria, and very very influential figure in many dimensions. So writing a tshuva here, responding to a case that came to him. Basically, it's a breakaway minyan wants to form out of an Egyptian shul. And this is, again, this is 16th century. We have to appreciate this is a time of great upheaval in the Jewish communities around the Mediterranean basin. The Gerush Svarad, the expulsion from Spain, was sending Spanish Jews all over the Mediterranean coast. Spanish Jews settling Italy, in the Balkans, across North Africa, and very importantly in Eretz Yisrael. And this became an Aliyah movement that, in a very linear sense, strengthened the critical mass of Jews in the land of Israel and led ultimately to, in a very linear sense, to the increase of Jews in the land of Israel, to, you could say, even to the establishment of the state of Israel in a certain sense. The Gerush Sfarad, an infusion of Jews coming into the land of Israel, invited by the Ottoman Turks, who wanted to build up Israel. Spain's loss was their gain. So there are Sephardic Jews settling all around the Mediterranean, and there are tensions developing with these communities. The Sephardic Jews have a bit of a sense of their nobility, they join the kahilos that are the native kahilos, and so we have North African shuls, Egyptian shuls, and in this one case, a group of Sephardic Jews, they call themselves the Kaposiim, meaning the caped ones. Think, you know, Zorro's cape, you know, that kind of thing. That was their distinctive type of dress. They had joined this Egyptian shul, which included a number of Tunisians as well, and then kind of fell out of favor with the leadership of the shul. They didn't want to daven the same way. They didn't want to pay the same taxes, and that became the most important issue of the kehillah. And this group of Sephardim and Tunisian Jews want to break away from the main shul in town, and the leaders of the main shul are trying to stop them, and they're appealing now to the Radvaz. And most of the tshuva is about financial issues. If they're going to break away, how do they apportion the taxes that have to be paid to the government? But at the beginning of the tshuva, the Radvaz raises the question, well, is it permissible to break away from an established kehillah? Isn't it important that a kehillah maintains its integrity? Barov am hadras melech, the more people there are, the more glory it is to God. Is it permissible? And he goes on to prove in a number of ways that if people have already fallen out of friendship with each other, if they're already, in fact, they're antagonistic to each other, and apparently this desire to break away has caused a lot of arguments in the shul, it's better that they break away anyway, if they're no longer friendly with each other. So this now leads to the heart of the tshuva here, and a very interesting move on the Radvaz's part. You have this, there's a Hebrew and an English version. I don't know what's the best way to do this, but in the interest of time, let's read through the English version with reference to the Hebrew. So he's given a number of proofs why it is that important that with people who are no longer friendly, they should already split and not daven together, not pray together. It says, you learn from all this that a person should not pray in a place in which his mind is troubled, nor at a time in which his mental focus is nullified. You know, he quoted many halakhic sources for this. On this basis, if an individual or group feels enmity or hatred or anger or contentiousness with the congregation. Their prayer is not acceptable, and it is forbidden for them to pray there, for the mind is troubled and they are unable to focus intent in their prayer. The proofs that he has brought deal with issues like if there's a bad fragrance in the shul, or there's other kinds of disturbances. But he applies this to these halakhic proofs to when there's emotional distress in the community, and if people are not feeling good about each other, then they shouldn't pray in a place where they're not feeling good about each other. All the more so is this so if they anger him to his face continually, and all the more so if the anger involves the leaders of the congregation. Right, and this is what was happening. The group that wants to break away are getting into constant arguments with the leadership that wants them to stay in and yet is not treating them very well. Okay. He says, Lule de Mistafina, in fact, I would dare say that it would be better for him to pray alone than to pray with a group of people with whom he is dissatisfied. There's another reason that it is not appropriate that a person pray other than in a place of his heart's desire. Just as said, the person does not learn Torah except in a place that his heart desires. Now, that's an interesting proof from the Gemara Avodah Zarah. A rather creative proof. I mean, looking into the text itself, about six lines in the Hebrew. Kechi de Amrinan, Ein Adam lo me Torah ela b'makom shelibo chafetz. Person doesn't learn Torah well except in a place that his heart desires. How does the word place, anyone knows that source in the Gemara? The word place in the Gemara refers to what? The subject matter, exactly. You know, in other words, what mesechta, what tractate would you like to learn? That's the discussion in the Gemara. And it's a question of the subject matter and where in the Gemara as a whole you'd like to learn. But the Radvaz rather creatively shifts this to place in the sense of a physical location. So the reason for this is that when a person, and now this is why a person learns better in a place that he likes to be and why he davens better in a place that he likes to be. Now, this is his summary. The reason is that when a person looks at someone that he gets satisfaction from, his soul is aroused to proper focused intent. His mind expands. His heart rejoices, and then the Spirit of God descends upon him, devolves upon him, as happens in Nevuah, as is mentioned by prophecy. Okay, so being in a place that you like to be with people that you like to be with gives you a sense of joy, and that enhances your kavana, and the opposite. So now, and this is the paragraph we want, and here it'd be good to see it in the Hebrew if you can, but it's the paragraph begins, they also say in the books of wisdom, Od Amru B'Sifrei HaChachma, and the books of wisdom for the Radvaz, as it becomes obvious, are the books of Kabbalah. Ki B'Yosa Adam Miskaven El Rabbo, Vinosein a love libo, tiskashev nasho benafshov yichol love mihashefa asher love yelo nefesh yisera, v'zeh nikra etzlam sod ha'ibor b'chayei shnehem. Okay, it says in the books of wisdom that when a person focuses on his teacher and gives him his heart, their soul is bound up, one soul with the other, and there devolves upon him from the efflux that is upon him, meaning the teacher, from the teacher to the student, and he gains a nefesh yisera, an extra soul. We know that term from Shabbos context. Okay, and in fact, the Kabbalists make a definite connection between the nefesh yisera, this extra soul that we receive as Shabbos comes in. It would be interesting to know what that really is and how do you experience that extra soul. And here too, we have the sense of an extra soul when the teacher and the student have a focused relationship and consciousness. There, so it devolves from the teacher to the student a nefesh yisera, And this is called by them Sod HaIbur B'Chayei Shnehem. To translate, the mystery of impregnation in when both are alive, on the lives of both of them. Now, that's a mouthful. The mystery of impregnation. This, the Ramban says, is one of the deepest secrets of Kabbalah. One that, in fact, he says one should not talk about, but here I am talking about it. It's been talked about a lot since the 16th century. The Ramban spoke about this in the 13th and saying this is one of the deepest secrets of Kabbalah. But already this issue is alluded to in the Zohar and discussed quite openly in the 16th century. And here we find the Radbaz, a major posek in a normative halachic discussion, you know, meant for a very broad audience, discussing one of the deepest, most closely held secrets of Kabbalah, the mystery of impregnation. Now, the phrase Soda Ibor, actually, where does that come from? And the Kabbalists are creatively, you know, reinterpreting a certain phrase. What's it? Yeah. The calendar, right? It's the notion of when we try to correlate the lunar cycle and the solar cycle, and we need to whether on the monthly basis or particularly as we're going to do this year to add another month of Darshani, the principles of knowing when to add days to the month or months to the year to coordinate the solar and lunar calendar was known as Soda Ibor, the secret of this. Of pregnancy, pregnant months, pregnant years, in that sense. The Kabbalists then take this term and apply it to an extraordinary way, to an extraordinary principle. Soda Ibor. This is the, and we'll see how the Arizal discusses this directly, or the Rav Yitzchak Luria. But here the notion is that there is an interpenetration of consciousness. He's talking about it from the teacher to the student. This, as it appears in Lurianic Kabbalah, is actually the more rare case. I mean, say rare, the more rarely discussed case. The most commonly discussed form of Soda Ibor in Kabbalistic literature deals, and you see this in much of the literature in the 15th century, but particularly in the 16th. The most common form is that there are times when a person alive in this life, feels deeply connected to a disembodied soul, someone who is no longer living, who lived at some time in the past, a disembodied soul, and that disembodied soul comes to inhabit the soul of the living person and gives them kind of a little bit of a boost, a spiritual boost, in fact, a big boost. This, of course, is in the context of the general Kabbalistic concept of Gilgul Neshama, the transmigration or reincarnation of souls. The notion that, and this is a well-accepted doctrine in Kabbalah, that we can come back multiple times working on different aspects of our, come back to in life, and our souls can incarnate multiple times, in the body to work on issues that we have not finished working on in past lifetimes, to continue working on them and working on them. This can go on for some eons, depending how quick a study we are in these matters. But the Kabbalists then talk about another phenomenon related, that a soul that is not in the body in this particular time, when it feels and senses an affinity to a soul that is in the body, someone living their life, and particularly we'll see it in the Arizal, when someone does a mitzvah in a certain deep way that the disembodied soul recognizes and maybe did a similar mitzvah in their own lifetime, when someone learns in a certain intense way or learns even the topics studied by that previous soul, whether that soul was a rabbinic teacher themselves or someone just learned. So someone, a disembodied soul, can come to inhabit the embodied living soul, the one that's in the world right now, and they kind of infuse one soul into the other. It's called an impregnation. It's not a Gilgul in the sense of a reincarnation, but that's a Gilgul is an incarnation for a lifetime. An Ibur, well, the Dibuk is the negative phenomenon of that. That's where a soul that's really struggling in the other world feels a more neurotic connection to someone in this world, and that's a pathological phenomenon. This is considered a very positive phenomenon, but it's a related issue. I mean, certainly so. So the neshama in the other world comes to infuse and suffuse their consciousness with the consciousness of the person in this world. That's the typical concept of soda ibor, the mystery of impregnation, it's understood. What the Radvaz is raising, though, and is another phenomenon which is actually more common, we'll see how common, yet less frequently discussed, and that's soda ibor b'chaye shnehem, the mystery of impregnation in the lives of both of them, or when both neshamos are in this life. And in other words, interpenetration of consciousness is not limited to a soul in the other world connecting with our soul and our consciousness in this world. It can also happen, in fact, happens frequently, all the time, an interpenetration of consciousnesses between us. And that's he gives the example of the teacher-student relationship. When there's good, clear focus between teacher and student, the soul of the teacher, the neshama of the teacher, and the flow of consciousness that is, and I should probably define soul here. Let's give a working definition of soul, of neshama. It's the deep structure of consciousness. Okay, so that's our working definition of soul, the deep structure of consciousness. When student and teacher are focused on each other, the consciousness of the teacher can actually suffuse the consciousness of the student, and that which is in the teacher can pass through and enter the student, not just in the words that are exchanged, it's not just on the verbal level, but on a more direct, almost telepathic level. Okay. And any good teacher knows that when you really are teaching, this is what's happening. It's not just in the words. The words can't convey enough. There has to be already a basis of understanding for student and teacher to get what's going on here. And so much more is conveyed than just the information that goes across verbally. It's this interpenetration of consciousness, which is, this is the fact of our existence. I mean, this is the ground of our common social existence. I mean, the very fact that we can sit around in a room here and pretend that we understand each other, is based on this notion that our consciousness already is interpenetrating. We're in the sea of it. And we recognize it in each other. We assume it in a certain sense. And this is this notion of soda ibor, the mystery of interpenetrating consciousness or shared consciousness, which is the ground of all sociality. I mean, this is really certainly the ground of all communication, on every possible level of communication. Well, I really find it remarkable that the Radvaz takes this deepest and yet most important and common teaching, this notion of soda ibor, the shared quality of consciousness, and refers to it in a tshuva, where he's just trying to justify breakaway minyan. But it's clear that it's something that he wants to convey, and it's a deeper lesson that he wants to get across in the context of what's going on around him. I mean, he sees all of these little groups of Jews coming from different places, maintaining their ethnic connections to the past places that they've been in. A lot of social tension developing in these shuls. We know this from Chuvos in Egypt. We know this shuls in Italy, in the Balkans, in Eretz Yisrael in this time. And he clearly wants to get across a sense of what is the... There's something much deeper going on here in our shared consciousness that we should be in tune with. speculate why he would bring such an esoteric doctrine into a tshuva. And he himself talks frequently in his own tshuva, frequently enough, about half a dozen times, about how you should be careful about mixing Kabbalah and Halakha. But here he does it, I think, to get across a lesson. So he goes on a little bit. So this is when the teacher and the student focus on each other, they can experience this Sod HaIbur, the mystery of impregnation, when both are alive. And this is what it's spoken as of, I was switching back to the English, when it says, your eyes shall see your teacher, that beautiful pasuk from Yeshayahu, and this is where it's referred to when it says, and you shall stand there, and I will, well, let's translate it for this purpose. So I will emanate from you a spirit. What's the reference to? The reference to in the Torah? Exactly, right? And at the end of Parshas Bahaloscha, and there's a direct emanation from the spirit of Moshe. God arranges an emanation, if you call it that, from the spirit of Moshe to the elders that are with him, a kind of direct teaching, we say that, an inspiration from Moshe to the elders, which grants them a deeper understanding and a deeper authority to become leaders in Israel, to share the burdens of leadership with Moshe Rabbeinu. So what the Ravaz is saying is that experience, what's going on in that experience between Moshe and the Zakenim, is a similar Sod HaIbur, okay, an infusion of consciousness from Moshe to the elders. Gein Hisalel Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Shim Haya Roa Es Pnei Rabo. You should read Rabo. It's actually in the Tshuva as Rabo, but it's Rabo. Haya Magil Madrega Elyona. And Rabbeinu, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, sort of glorified in the fact that if he had seen the face of his teacher, and his teacher was Rabbi Meir, okay, and I brought the text down at just below, had he ever been able to see the face of his Meir, Rabbi Meir, his teacher, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi would have risen to an even higher level. Famous passage in the Gemara Erevin, where Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says that the fact that I'm sharper than my colleagues is because I got to sit behind my teacher, Rabbi Meir, when he taught. I know that was very close personal contact with him in Shir. I sat close to him, but behind him. And had I been able to sit in front of him, I would have been even greater, even sharper. Now, I mean, you had to, I mean, in yeshiva, when I was at YU, learning with the Rav Zatzal, it was sort of like this. We were arranged in concentric circles around the Rav who sat up front, and, Rav Soloveitchik, and some of the students, very sharp, the sharpest students were in the first circle, and then the next circle, and then the next circle back. It was a kind of this pecking order, and everyone knew their place, very much set up like the old yeshivos in Bavel, in the time of the Gaonim, back from the time of the Amoraim. So everyone kind of knew their place, and there were guys that were sitting behind the Rav, just like that, because they were kind of in circles around the Rav, and they didn't get to see the Rav face to face, but they were very close to him. They were sitting sort of behind. What's Rabbi Yehuda Nasi telling us here? The fact that I'm sharper than my colleagues, I sat right behind Rabbi Meir, and had I been able to sit in front of him, I would have been even sharper. Why? What is this proximity and then face-to-face relationship? Your eyes should see your teacher. Why is that? What's going on in teaching that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is referring to here? It's not just the words. In other words, anybody in the room could hear the words of Rabbi Meir. Pardon me? Well, and there is a Sod HaIbur, yeah, but he's not referring, I mean, in the Gemara Erevin, it's not referring, talking in those terms, but What do we get by seeing our teacher, or, you know, being in close proximity, not just hearing the words? I mean, they're making a tape of this this talk, as they're making a tape of all the talks, and there are people who will listen to the tape, and they'll get whatever experience they get from it. But, you know, you guys have paid tuition to come and see me face to face. You know, what do you get from this? Facial expressions, what else? The nuances, you know, the body language, and a connection. In the teaching experience, so much more is conveyed than just words. So we use the words, but the words are just a vehicle for really consciousness to consciousness connection. There's even, you know, for those of you who are teachers or, you know, teach in some way, you know this, that there's even, and I don't want to get too out there with this, but there's even a kind of dimension, a telepathic dimension. A good teacher has a very clear sense of what he or she wants to get across. It's a clear idea. Could be in a visual image, could be in an auditory form, whatever it is that they want to get across. And to the extent that you have a clear sense of this, you're able to communicate it. The words, you know, words have their own kind of, words are pretty malleable, but they have their own stiffness as well. If it were all just in the words, we wouldn't really be able to teach enough. We wouldn't be able to get it across enough. But there's much more happening in the teaching experience. And that almost, I'll call it almost telepathic kind of connection that we have, this is what you get from that personal contact. And that's what the Radvaz is also referring to in this tshuva. He says, the kol shekein im harav miskaven gam hu the korazeh el zeh lahashpia v'zeh lekabel. Nicely woven in. All the more so when the teacher himself focuses his intent, and they call unto each other. Of course, korazeh el zeh. In other words, a very nice shibutz understand referring to what? Well, the angels. In other words, in other words, this is angelic communication that's going on here. Zel hashpil, zel kabel. This one to give influence. The other to receive influence. So in the teaching experience, there's a kind of an angelic communication that's going on as well. It's a beautiful image. This is therefore also by Rabbi Yossi. Says that not every person can learn from every other person, and halachically, therefore, a person can leave and even leave against his parents' wishes to learn with another teacher, because it's that personal connection is precious, unique, and not everybody can establish that connection, etc. This is the basis for the Radvaz justifying this notion of a breakaway minyan. How's that? In other words, if people don't have this connection, if enmity has crept into the relationship and they're angry with each other, then they aren't able to have this easy communication, this supportive communication, this sense of of strong, inspiring connection with each other. And it's better that they should already split apart and daven with people that they enjoy davening with. And the principle of Barov Am Hadras Melech, that the more people there are together, the greater glory it is to God, this gets pushed aside in the face of this issue. Interesting tshuva, exploring this notion of Soda Ibor, the impregnation, meaning the mixing of consciousness between people, not just from the other world into this world, but people in this world. In fact, as we'll see, it's understood to be the basis of all communication at its and all empathy and all compassion at its deepest level. Let's look a little bit further into the way that the Arizal, the Lurianic Kabbalists, analyze this phenomenon. So you have, in fact, let's look at the English version. I put a little bit more in here into the English version. I tried to make the Hebrew version fit on the page for the sake of Torah and Motion people. But on page 2, it says Rav Chaim Vital Shara Gilgulim, that this mystery of impregnation can refer to the living. That is, sometimes a person gets the opportunity to do a certain mitzvah and he does it properly, and then the soul of one of the earlier righteous ones who performed that very same mitzvah properly comes to him, and since they resemble each other in this mitzvah, the soul of the righteous one impregnates within him. So, what becomes the basis for a soda ibur in this Lurianic Kabbalah? This is Rechaim Vital, 16th century. How do people attune to each other? Performing mitzvos, which are transcendent moments in our lives, ideally, and as we can, the way in which we and the quality in which we perform a mitzvah, the kavanah that we bring to it, the power of our performance of this mitzvah, if it kind of resonates with a neshama, and he's talking about a neshama in the other world now, not in this world, that neshama is attracted to us in this world and comes to impregnate, which is to say that and you feel a spiritual lift. I don't know if be sensitive. It's happening to us more often than we imagine. It's happening to us quite a bit. And there are times when you feel a little bit of a lift, a little bit of an inspiration. You're in the midst of teaching something, and all of a sudden you kind of get a better idea, a clearer idea of it. You get a little bit more passionate about it. You suddenly have some innovative sense of it that you didn't have before. You're getting a little boost. Where is that coming from? So that's from one neshama in the other world to our neshama in this world. Not only that, says Rav Chaim Vital, it's also possible when that righteous one is with him in his own lifetime, his soul can impregnate within him for the reason mentioned. For when the person does some mitzvah or mitzvot that are related to the righteous one, which he also does just like him properly, then the soul of the righteous one impregnates with him, even though they are both alive together. Okay? So there can be this attunement of souls, you know, when we're both in this world together. Okay, and this is a b'chaye shnehem, soda ibur b'chaye shnehem. And this is the mystery of the verse, and the soul of David inhered in Yonatan. It's actually the soul of Yonatan was tied to the soul of David, and Yonatan loved him like his own soul. So that relationship between Yonatan and David here is understood as this kind of infusion of souls. While both of them were alive together, the soul of David impregnated within Yonatan. Which is, in other words, soda ibur is the basis of profound friendship. Certainly within in relationship between husbands and wives on many different levels, but here, profound friendship. It goes in the next one down, also from Shara Gilgulim. The issue of the teacher with the student is that the teacher places his spirit within the student, similar to the father and the child, except that the bond is stronger. Since that spirit will remain with the student forever and ever, existing eternally, they shall never be separated, according to the mystery of the soul of David and Hirden and Yonatan. So here, Rav Chaim Vital is getting across that the teacher-student relationship can be even more profound than a father or a mother and child relationship. He'll go on to talk about the fact that when the parents are also teachers, that there's nothing stronger than that. And certainly, when parents teach their children and are intimately involved with their children's learning, there's no stronger bond than that. But the notion of a teaching relationship as the deepest kind of interpenetrating of consciousness is an important idea. I mean, think of it. I mean, the ways in which, you know, the important teachers, or truly almost every teacher in your life and in your educational history, when you talk and when you, you know, relate and when you think, when you converse, you are often expressing those patterns that you have learned, those ideas that you've learned, not just the words that you've learned from your teachers, but the spirit of your teachers, the enthusiasm of your teachers. I mean, and you know, for better and sometimes for worse, but you know, all of the contours of the ways in which your teachers have inspired you and put their mind in your mind, their words in your mind, but also their mind in your mind. That's something that we continue to carry forth and to communicate and convey to each other. It's a profound relationship. Yeah. Yeah, so it's, again, he's and that's true. So it's he's actually justifying the break, which is the Radvaz doesn't say let's try to work this out. Which is interesting. He could have just become a mediator for these groups, but he doesn't. He justifies the break, but he justifies the break in terms of people feeling more comfortable with those that are like them. Now this could lead to even greater sectarianism, in Le Dover Sof here, but so we don't have to. We could follow that. I mean, that issue. But I would back away from that, at least for the purpose of this talk, to focus on the principle of connection that he is highlighting. And even though perhaps he should have worked with the Tunisian and Sephardic community to reconcile and connect with the Egyptian community a little bit better. But whatever. He was there. I wasn't. We weren't. You know. So we're not going to judge him. Now I want to take this to another level. This was a very esoteric Kabbalistic idea in the 13th century and on. It is alluded to in the Zohar, but also in a very delicate way. It becomes a much more open concept in the 16th century, and this notion of interpenetrating consciousness, and it itself is rooted in a conceptual foundation in Kabbalah itself that is articulated in a number of places, but I thought for our purposes convenient and sort of clearly stated example is in the Nefesh HaChaim of Rav Chaim of Volozhin, the great colleague of the Vilna Gaon in the 18th century, the Lithuanian Kabbalist tradition. And here the Nefesh HaChaim is essentially an introduction to Kabbalah and includes as well the manifesto of the Yeshiva movement in the fourth part. But it's a profound work. And here he's talking about really the structure, the inner structure of reality, the structure of heaven. He's referring to the Merkava vision of Yechezkel, right, the chariot vision of Yechezkel, and talking about the different levels of that vision and correlating it to Kabbalistic theory. And we don't have to get into the technical aspects of it, but this is the phrase that I just wanted to pull out of that. It says, the Nishmat HaChayim, the soul of life, of the throne, the Kisei HaKavod, the divine throne, in Yechezkel's vision. So remember, Yechezkel's vision, it's a must-read for anyone at all interested in, Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism, chapter 1, he has a vision of a chariot, right, with an angelic chariot, for the Chayos HaKodesh, angelic living beasts, living entities, angels making up the chariot, and the wheels itself are forms of angels. This chariot is essentially the engine of reality. Okay, the vehicle or engine of reality. I mean, be a little flippant here. Say, if Yechezkel was having this vision today, what would the chariot look like? Probably. Yeah, I would say something like an SUV with all the options. Don't want to be too flippant. It was a chariot. Okay, it is a chariot. But to get across that notion, it is the vehicle and engine of reality. Above that is the Kerach HaNorah, the awesome ice firmament. Above that is whatever the word above means, is the Akise, right? That's the throne of glory, as it comes to be known. And on the throne of glory is what? Sitting upon the throne of glory, so to speak, is what? Well, actually, what it actually says is the image, as it were, of the likeness, as it were, of the similitude, a whole bunch of caveats, of a man, right, Adam, sitting on the throne. And we jump to the conclusion that that is a god. Well, that, very disturbing notion, actually, if we thought that that's God sitting on a throne. And it's been a lot of meforshim, of commentators have addressed this problem. The Kabbalistic tradition on this, and here's Chaim Volozhin brings this. The soul of life, Nishmas HaChaim, of the throne, of the Kisei, what is the inner principle of the throne of glory? is the mystery of the supernal root of the totality of the souls of Israel as one. It's quite a phrase. Sod shorash elyon shel klolos nishamos Yisrael yachad. Shehu yoser gavoa ma'od ne'elam gam min hakiseh. That's a great phrase. It's not God in the sense of, it's not God. It's the souls of the totality of Israel as one. So what is that? Okay, the totality, let's say it this way, that Adam, right, that image as it were of man, is the totality of the souls of Israel as one. What can we put that into any kind of a modern idiom? Collective consciousness of the Jewish people, let's take it that way. You know, not collective unconscious, but just what you said. The collective consciousness of the Jewish people. That first of all, that our consciousness is collective. Right? And that's an important point. Again, that's the basis of our sociality, of our compassion, of our empathy for each other, of our communication with each other, of sitting in this room together and pretending that we actually know what we're talking about together. That, you know, that basis for that is that really we are a common consciousness. That's where we start. And even when we have, that's exactly the point. Now, the baseline is we are common consciousness, and we recognize this in each other. It's the first thing we get. Emmanuel Levinas, in one of his essays, points out that the first instant when two human beings meet, there's that instant recognition of common consciousness. It's so common, you know, it's like just hi. But he says you cannot avoid in your first encounter with another human being of sensing them in their full conscious being and feeling that connection. We then jump to other things, and we might get into talking, and we might get into other themes, and we thematize, or we might even, he says, even when we try to avoid recognizing the other because we're angry with the other person, we still. You know, it's not like we just pass a tree, a tree is actually pretty nice too, but it's not just like if you pass, some inanimate object, it's a person. And even if we don't, even if we're angry with that person, in fact, sometimes even especially, we sense them in that instant, they're in their conscious presence. We feel that connection. You know, in fact, it can kind of even be a bit of a shock sometimes, and we feel that connection. So the baseline, according to Rav Chaim of Volozhin, and in truth, we're going to look at Levinas in a second. The baseline is connectedness, is common consciousness. That's what we're working with all the time. We do overlay that. We can overlay that with enmity, with hatred, with falling out of friendship, which is tragic. But there's also the ground for repair, always. The ground for repair, for rediscovering the basis of compassion and the basis of commonality, because common consciousness, we are in this. Consciousness is still the big mystery. Okay? With all the great mysteries in astrophysics that are legitimate mysteries, and the mysteries of biology, that's my little bell. All of these, the great mysteries of science. Really, the cutting edge of science today, and the mystery that remains least understood and least known of all, is what is consciousness? Yeah, what is this? Whether it's Rav Chaim Volozhin, whether it's the Radbaz and the Kabbalists, the Lurianic Kabbalists, the Rav Chaim, and Levinas himself,
they understand. Almost 12:30.
Thanks. Yeah. We're going to take a little bit more because we started late. Okay, huh?
Yeah.
Just a little more. And Levinas himself makes this the very basis of his most important philosophic work, is the common consciousness that we share, which is the ground of everything. We can alienate ourselves, but that commonality is there always from the start. I gave you a little passage in the English section, not in the Hebrew, from Levinas's, basically, this is his major work. If you're not familiar with Emmanuel Levinas, I hope you are. I consider myself a Levinas groupie, and I try to promote Levinas wherever I go. Do read him. You could either his nine Talmudic readings, which are delightful in English. You guys read French, so you can see him in the original, or in Totality and Infinity, which is his major work. And here's a passage here, noting that the and let me I'll just say it on the outside, but you look at it at your leisure on the inside. That what connects us together is even deeper than the Socratic method, says, which assumes that there are certain I have eternal truths that I understand, you have eternal truths, and if I'm a good teacher, we can bring out the eternal truths from each other. He says, it's much deeper than that. You know, it is consciousness itself that we share. It is, and that consciousness is an opening to the infinite that we share, Ein Sof. But Levinas was a Torah Jew, as well as arguably the most important continental philosopher of the 20th century. I insist on that. And it says what we share is consciousness, which is the opening to the infinite. It's Ein Sof, and he means this philosophically and Kabbalistically, the opening to the infinite. And because consciousness is not a force, it's not even a phenomenon, it's a non-phenomenon. It doesn't show itself, it's just its opening. It's our ability to be open to others, to each other. And we begin with that opening. It's before any kind of sharing of information, it's before any kind of communication. It's the ground of communication and the ground of compassion and the ground of all connection. That opening to the infinite that consciousness is. And he expresses it eloquently. His language is a little bit dense, but you can look at it at your leisure. And it's this that I want to suggest, to put us in contact with each other around the table, in the room, in the sense that here we are in this moment together experiencing this common consciousness. We do it all the time, and it's the most precious thing in the world. We overlook it because we're on to other things. It's the most precious ground of all relationship in the world. It's how, Yaakov and Esav could, even just for a moment, reconcile as two brothers, human beings and brothers, with all the past enmity that they had between them, but that they could recognize even for a moment that connection, their commonality. They could embrace and kiss and really mean it, and cry over that moving moment. It's a most touching moment in the Torah, and a most hopeful moment, truly, in the Torah and in for all of human history. This most hopeful moment, the possibility of reconciliation, a possibility of empathy and compassion. And just wanted to recommend this to you as the basis for everything that we're talking about at this conference. Every one of the teachers and all of you here are gathered really to try to bring out the sense of compassion and love that there is in Torah, that there is in Halakha, because this is the Torah that we love, and this is the Torah that it's about. So I wanted to begin with that topic today. Thank you.